is nothing more dangerous, Paul, than a woman of my age, because I have nothing to lose.
Welcome to our second episode of Season 3 of Centerpiece NY, the podcast where you can channel the many undercurrents that flow through the great city of New York and its huge hinterland. In the words of Irish people who have come to spend some serious time in and around the Big Apple. This is Paul Finnegan, the creator, producer, and the presenter of this podcast. Why Irish people, you might ask? Because I happen to know so many of them. Low-hanging fruit, yeah? In this episode, we get to know Helen McNamara O'Shea from Limerick in Ireland, an accomplished doctor who finally got the permission she needed to try her hand at another kind of healing, a career as a singer-songwriter. And, let the record reflect, her husband Paul O'Shea was all for it.
Centerpiece NY is supported by Fox Lifestyle Hospitality Group, an experienced culinary and beverage company and originators of a suite of fine Manhattan hospitality establishments comprising The Rag Trader, The Parlor Room, The White Oak Tavern, Bo Peep Cocktail and Highball Store, and Street Taco at two locations. With his unique ability to create classic and timeless restaurants and bars, founder and Dubliner Mark Fox has been instrumental in the design and execution of some of the most successful neighborhood mainstays in New York City. Fox Lifestyle Hospitality Group is committed to providing consistently outstanding guest experiences led by a vision of genuine, welcoming hospitality. Find out more about Fox Lifestyle Hospitality Group at flhgrp.com.
Hey, darling, when you cast your charm, you knew I'd keep you safe from harm.
Let's kick off this episode with a note about naming conventions. The fact that for so long in Northern European history, and still to this day, a woman took her husband's name must drive genealogists crazy at times. How often do these family tree cartographers find a branch they are researching, covering periods with poor or non-existent written records, come to a withering end because a woman's birth family disappeared from the narrative at marriage, and, some might say, a woman's life before her wedding was erased too? Now, it must be said, the Spanish and the people of Iceland, and no doubt many other tribes, do the naming thing very differently. But we're not talking about them, are we? However, the times they are a-changing in this regard, and our centerpiece for this episode has been making her own choices with respect to her surname all along, so let's jump in there to begin to get to know Helen.
Araiglinnish then, Helen.
Araigling. Mahan vocal.
Gurmahagut. So Helen McNamara O'Shea, that's a long double-barreled name. Can you tell us a little bit about how you've arrived at that name?
Well, Paul, it's a very recent event, actually, that I put the two names together. For most of my life, my name was and is Helen McNamara. I'm the proud daughter of Sergeant Joe McNamara of Ballylanders in County Limerick and Josephine McNamara, his wife, Josephine Ryan McNamara. And because I had gone to medical school and all of my research papers and all of my qualifications and everything were under my father's name, I never really changed it. When I got married in 92 back in Ireland, I was still working in clinical practice. So I went by Dr. McNamara all the time. And then when we moved to Montreal, it was easy because all of the women there go by their maiden name. It's just a Quebec thing. So I would have been McNamara regardless. But when we moved to the US, my children were enrolled in the local public school and they said to me, you know, Mom, Dad's an O'Shea and we're O'Shea's and you really should be an O'Shea too. So I couldn't change any of my legal documents, like my driver's license, my passport, everything is all McNamara. But for the school and just for, you know, the friends and everything, I started going by Helen O'Shea, which was really nice because it was like I got to reinvent myself completely as a new person when we moved to the States. And I went by Helen O'Shea since we moved. And into my recording career and singer-songwriting, I continued as Helen O'Shea because, first of all, it's much easier to say than Helen McNamara. And second of all, it was my husband, Paul O'Shea, who was the one who encouraged me to go back into music when I needed to take time out from my career in medicine to support the children through the move. So just recently on LinkedIn, I had been McNamara. And then I was like, you know something? I have to honor the two parts of myself and I have to somehow bring them together. So now I'm back to Helen McNamara O'Shea, which fully describes my past, present and future.
So let's talk a little bit later about your transition into music, but give us a little bit more about your background in Ireland and the fact that you ended up studying up in Galway, where you were in the same class as my sister Maureen for a time.
Honestly, wasn't that hilarious when we were at the Big Irish Campfire in New York and we happened to sit together and like the Irish, we know someone everywhere, no matter where we go. I was dumbfounded to find out that I'd been in class with Maureen for 6 years in Galway and suddenly end up sitting with her brother and we got on like a house on fire. So basically, I was a policeman's daughter. I worked very hard in school because my father used to like to see me do well in school and I was an absolute daddy's girl. Like I was very like my father and we had a great relationship. All of his sisters were midwives. So when I was very, very young, I'd be taken into the mat in Limerick and I'd get to see all the babies in the incubators and everything. And so I decided I wanted to be a nurse and then I wanted to be a midwife. And then I was doing really well in school. And then my father got it into his head, God rest his soul, that, you know, I was doing good in school and maybe I'd go on and be a doctor and do medicine. And sure, I thought back in those days that the only people that became doctors were the doctor's sons, you know, that it was a skill that was passed down from one generation to the next.
Like being a TD, for example.
Well, being a TD or a cobbler or a plumber. Do you know what I mean? That it was like a trade or whatever. No, my father was hell-bent anyway that he was going to support me in any way he can. And God bless him, he put four of us through college on a policeman's salary and then went back to college himself. I have so much admiration for him. He was on about being a doctor. And I was terrified, Paul. Like anytime I saw blood, I fainted. And I was like, there's no way I'm going to be able to do this. And in the meantime, I was in a duo in high school with this girl, Mary Carey, really talented songwriter. And I think she's a lawyer now. I've been trying to find her, but I haven't been able to. We went away to the Charismatic Renewal Camp in Fenor in County Clare. And I met this fellow from Cavan who was starting a band. And he told me that he'd love me to be the lead singer in the band when I turned 18 and I could leave home. So I went home and told my father anyway that I had great news that I was going to join a band in Cavan. And he used every curse word that some I had never heard before. And he told me in no uncertain terms that I was going to college, I was going to be a doctor and get a real job. So anyway, I ended up in Galway, the most wonderful place to go to medical school, I have to say. I had 6 unforgettable years in Galway in medical school and just fell in love with obstetrics and gynecology, which is, you know, what all my aunts had done as midwives, taking care of mothers and babies. You know, I met my husband in my last year of college in Galway. He was a PhD in chemistry in Ullscoil na Gáilimhe, and as it's called now again. So that was how I ended up in Galway and that was how I ended up becoming a doctor. I think I was in third med when all of my sisters and brothers had made it through college because obviously I was the last one, medicine being a 6-year program back then, you know. I remember being on the phone outside the regional hospital in Galway in the payphone to my father and him telling me that he had gotten into college in Limerick and he had just done his first exam and there was 100 questions on the paper, but he got 30 of them and he thought, sure, 30 is better than 0. I'd say I did fairly well. And I just couldn't tell him, like, there's no feckin' way you did well if you answered 30 questions out of 100. But anyway, he must have figured out how to do, you know, multiple choice, even at his age, because he went on to Blackhall Place and became a lawyer. And he was on his way to work in the law offices of Robin Lee and Kilmallock on the morning that he had the accident where he passed away. So he's a great inspiration to me. And also, I think, gave me permission to transition my career at a time when everybody thought I was crazy. But it was definitely the right move for me and my family at the time.
How many years ago was your father had the accident and passed away?
It was on July 29th in 2008. Very, very, very sad day. We think that the car slipped. You know, it had been really lovely weather and then it rained very heavily. And we think he might have lost control. My mother's in heaven now, so I can tell you this. she went to see like a soothsayer or, you know, a person who communicates with the people in heaven. And she told my mother that he swerved to avoid a badger. So that made my mother happy that he was trying to save an animal. And he went into the ditch and at 10 o'clock in the morning on his way to the office. So that was a very, very tough time. But I feel him with me all the time. And the morning of the burial of the funeral, when they put the coffin in the ground, I saw a white butterfly fly out of the hole, right? And I'm going to my brother, did you see that? My brother thought I had lost it. And it's the weirdest thing, Paul. I came back to Montreal where I was living at the time. I was walking downtown outside McGill University in the middle of the city. And this white butterfly appears in front of me. And then we were moving from Montreal to Princeton. The morning we were going to the airport, one of my friends was driving me and my daughter, and the other was driving my husband and my son behind me. And a white butterfly landed on the windscreen on the main thoroughfare on the way to the airport in Montreal. And when we arrived down at the house, and you might have to edit some of this out because it sounds so crazy, at our new house here in Princeton, at the mailbox, I have photographic evidence of a white butterfly being here when we arrived at the house to move in. And that's why I called my company White Butterfly Music. But my brother, Steve McNamara, he's a very, very good lawyer in Nina in Ireland. And he, when he has a few pints, says to me, "When you feck off with your cabbage slice." So he doesn't take any notice of me, but I believe what
I romanticize the white butterfly at all.
He's always bringing me down to earth in his gentle way. But I know he's great crack. But what you call, I believe it, and it gives me great comfort, and it seeps its way into my music and the songs that I write, and people respond to them, and that's okay. You know, we all have our ways of coping.
Of course, of course. Certainly there's a spiritual component to our lives that we can't understand, in my opinion anyway.
He was very well known in the community as a policeman and a lawyer. So it was all over the papers and write-ups and photographs and everything. And in one of the write-ups, it said he was 73, but he was 74. And all of his friends were saying, oh, he'd be delighted that they missed a year, that they made him a year younger than he actually was, you know. And he was 74, going on 40, if you know what I mean. Like he had a good 20 years to give still. His funeral was so beautiful. And for that, we have to thank the Gardaí in Henry Street and on the Ennis Road. They gave him such a send-off. You know, they had motorbikes at every roundabout. And when we came out of the funeral home, there were squad cars with their lights flashing and everything. And my father would have been delighted with himself, so he would. But the Gardaí were absolutely fabulous to my mother and to all of the family. I mean, we were very, very lucky the way we were taken care of by, you know, the boys in blue. They definitely take care of their own, and I have so much respect for them all.
He was definitely a man who commanded a lot of respect and affection. When did your mother pass away?
Well, my mom's, God love her, she passed away in March of 2019. I went home when she was sick and for the funeral. And then, you know, we have this lovely tradition in Ireland called the month's mind. So I went home for the month's mind as well. That's like the final goodbye when you're kind of recovered a little bit from the numbness and stuff, and it's more of like a party or whatever. So I haven't been home since then. So it's my first time going home. You know, the whole place has been sold and stuff, so I'm a little bit nervous about it. But the interesting thing about my mother was, I honestly feel when we lost my father, you know, that was her best friend. And I think that we had her for 10 years after he died. And every one of those years was really for the kids. I think she just wanted to be with him, but she was there for the kids and the grandkids and whatever. And she was admitted in Ennis for some kind of renal function issue. We all thought she had a kidney infection and that she'd be home like within a week. But within a week, she'd been diagnosed with terminal bowel cancer that none of us knew about. And she passed away 3 days later under hospice care in Ennis. And I have to say, the nurses and the team in Ennis Hospital were second to none. I've worked in hospitals in 4 different countries and I've met wonderful caregivers, but I have never met the caliber of the caregivers at Ennis Hospital who took care of my mother. They were unreal, unbelievable, and just fabulous.
How old was your mother when she died?
Well, my mother was 84, but the year before she died, she had a terrible fall. She fell backwards down the stairs in her house in Limerick, and we all thought we'd lost her then. So we kind of got an extra year that made us all very grateful, you know, at the end.
the specific part of Limerick you grew up in? Was it a small town or was it part of Limerick City?
Actually, that's a great question. I initially grew up in Rathkeel, County Limerick, and we were living in a tiny, tiny house with an outside toilet until I was 13. So I'm no stranger to hardship and freezing cold in the winter, going out to the backyard, you know. And then my father got promoted and he became the sergeant in Ballylanders, which is on the other side of Limerick near Mitchellstown. So then we were living in the barracks. So yeah, a lovely place to live and, you know, an outside backyard and everything. That was where I was until I went to Galway. Now, subsequently, when my father retired and went to join the law practice in Kilmallock with Robin Lee, they moved into Limerick City because my sister and my brothers were going to college in Limerick. But I went to Galway from Ballylanders.
Now, just to reintroduce music into the life of the budding doctor, my question is, although your father wasn't too enthused about you pursuing music professionally at such a young age, what was your involvement with music? Were you a singer? Did you play an instrument? Were you into trad? What was your profile in music in your teens?
That's a really good question, Paul. The irony of it is that my father absolutely loved traditional music. So he had us all enrolled in something, but he only figured it out when it was a little too late for me, like I was already in high school. But the lads, my two brothers, played fiddle and concert flute. And my sister played accordion. And I tried to play accordion, but I was never very good at the coordination. And I was dying for him to get me lessons in Shano singing. I don't think he had as much respect for the singing as he did for the actual playing of the instruments. So I learned piano badly and I learned piano accordion badly. So my only involvement with groups like Colts Kilsory Éireann would be that I'd be playing like the bass notes for the band on the piano because that was all I was able to do. But my mother was an absolutely beautiful singer. I remember her singing from when I would be sitting on her knee and she knew all the old songs and she like knew 40 verses of We'll Say Skibbereen and she'd sing them all, right? Whenever we would meet up with our cousins in America, the McComiskeys, and I don't know if you know, but my cousin, Billy McComiskey, is great friends with Donny Carroll.
Donny, you will recall, was our centerpiece for episode 1 of season 3.
And was in the band with Maloney, God rest his soul, the Green Fields of America. So Billy is a world champion button accordion player, and he's actually an Irish Heritage Fellow here in the US. So he's very well known, very humble, of course. But we used to be going to all the flat shows in Ireland to see Billy playing because he was winning left, right and centre when we were kids. That's when my father got the bug and I'd be begging him, will you send me to Shannon singing? No, no, no. So I would listen to my mother sing and I would sing with her and she used to sing with such feeling and the story songs and whatever. Then in high school, like I told you, I was in this duo with Mary Curry, this beautiful songwriter. She had a very high voice. So I had a lower voice and she had this song, Father and Son by Cat Stevens. And we would do it at every festival and every school event. And she'd do the son part and I'd do the father part. So that was the first song I ever performed for an audience. And then in Fionnuala with these charismatic renewal people, sure, we were singing all the time. The whole mass was sung and everything. And then when my father said, get that out of your fucking head and the rest of the stuff he told me, I closed the door and I closed it firmly. And I went off to college and I never sang again. And I never even thought about it on the night of his funeral. And that was the night before the whole White Butterfly incident. You know, the night before, after the removal, before the burial and with the house full of people. I remember standing in the middle of the kitchen. I remember exactly who was there and thinking, who am I going to call now when my research gets accepted in, you know, Switzerland or if I get invited to speak in such and such a place? Because I had done some really interesting research with people in the States and I was flying all over the place presenting. He got more of a kick out of it than I did. But then I realized, you know, nobody else was going to care. And I was doing it for him. And when I flew back from his funeral on the flight, I got a napkin on the plane and I wrote down 10 songs that I wanted to record before I died. That was what I came away from his funeral with. So that was the beginning of the second phase of my music life.
And of course, you know, we look at our parents growing up in the Depression and other, you know, aspects of Irish life, Irish rural life, even urban life. Poverty was only one step away. So we can understand now how cautious and conservative they were about putting their children in a place where they could make a living and, you know, have a life. And not to be tied up with the highfalutin ideas about the arts and things.
It's very poignant that you actually said what you just did. And I really feel like there's a reason for it because, you know, I went through a phase where, you know, I was mad at him for dying. First of all, of course, it wasn't his fault. I was mad at him for leaving me because he really was my compass. My whole life was all about what would he like and what was for him. His reasoning for me having something that I could fall back on was his father was an alcoholic. God love him. You know, he had that awful disease of alcoholism. And they had like 8 or 9 children in the family. And there was a couple in Cavan that didn't have any children. And some arrangement was made that my father would be taken away from his family, away from his brothers and sisters in Tipperary. And he would go and live with this family that were friends with his mother in Cavan. Like at age like 7 or 8, which when I think of it, when I had my own son, I would cry when I think of my poor father. And in those days, it was a horse and cart. There wasn't cars or anything, right? So he's separated from all of them and he's up with this other family. And he blamed his father for that because he figured if his father hadn't drank, as he said himself, the last cow on the farm, they would have been able to keep the family together and he wouldn't have been sent away. Now, he was always very clear about the fact that he probably did better than his brothers and sisters because when he would bring them home an orange, they would think they'd died and gone to heaven, you know, and he was the only child in this house. But what he didn't tell me and what I found out from my mother only 2 years before she passed away, I was talking about it one night and I was like, you know, I don't think he realized how hard medicine is when he just, you know, easily just sent me off to that life. You don't realize at 18 years of age, the horrors that you're going to see and the things you're going to get exposed to, you know. But my mother then told me the full story. And the full story, Paul, was they had a farm. They had no children. So they wanted a boy to run the farm for them. Now, it turned out that my father was really bright, really intelligent, and he was going to, like, you know, the school that had one room and one teacher. The teacher told the villagers or whatever how bright he was and how he should be able to go to college, but nobody had the money, right? And so the village got together and they raised the money to send my father to university, whatever it was back then. And this couple that had raised him said, no, his job is to work our farm until we die or whatever. And they wouldn't let him go. So then he escaped and started working in the mines in Nina, silver mines. And then he joined the guards because at the time they would teach you how to drive. And it was the closest you could get to law, which is what he had to do. So that makes the story of him putting his 4 children through college and then going back to college himself and then becoming a lawyer and a really good lawyer. Like everybody knew him from when he was a policeman in the general area of Limerick, Tipperary, Clare. So he had loads and loads of clients and they all adored him. And the night of his funeral, we sat in that funeral home. I can laugh now, my poor mother. We sat in that funeral home for 3.5 hours while the line came through and the actual mass that was supposed to be at 7 started at 9.
Amazing. Your father has an amazing story. Can you tell me what age he started studying for law?
I would say it must have been 55 or 56.
Oh, fantastic. What a brave thing to do.
Brave doesn't cover it. I mean, the neck on the man. He was in heaven once he got into college to do law at that hour of his life. This is a policeman who, without anyone knowing, would pack hampers for local prisoners' families at Christmas and take me out to deliver them and tell me not to tell anyone. Do you know what I mean? He was a very special man.
And now a word from our friends at the Celtic Irish American Academy in Galway.
Brian Fahey here, director of the Celtic Irish American Academy. We are based in Salthill, Galway, Ireland, and operate a 2-week immersive program for American high school students. The students live in Galway for the 2 weeks and explore Irish culture, heritage, sports, STEM, leadership and service learning in a classic Irish setting. Now in our 7th year, our program has received fantastic reviews. Enrollment for our July 2023 program is now taking place. Come join us on this wonderful adventure.
This is Caitlin from Parkland, Florida. In July 2019, I attended the Celtic Irish American Academy as an emerging Irish American young leader, fully immersing in the culture and heritage of Galway, Ireland. We stayed with an outstanding host family for 2 weeks, touring and attending classes on leadership, business, and volunteering. The memories I have and the friendships I made will last a lifetime.
For more information, visit our website at CelticIrishAmericanAcademy.com. And now, back to Centerpiece NY.
Just about your husband, he wouldn't be, he's a chemist, not a doctor. But is he also?
Well, he is. He'll tell you that he's a real doctor, Paul.
Oh, yeah.
Like when we finally get to all have dinner together.
Doctor of philosophy.
He'll tell you he's a real doctor because he has a PhD. I'm only a Mickey Mouse doctor. But he's very right. Funny because before I met him, he was renowned among his group of friends for thinking that medical students were stupid, right? And he would tell anyone who had to listen. Medical students are stupid. And his rationale was that doing his PhD in chemistry, he'd be in the lab in Galway trying to teach people like me chemical experiments that I could care less about because I only cared about people, right? But you had to jump through the hoops, you jump through physics, and you had to jump through chemistry and some other stuff that really wasn't relevant, but you had to do the sciences because you had to know them. And I can quite safely say that I never used anything in chemistry in a clinical setting ever. So he was kind of right. But sure, for us, we'd be all paying attention in anatomy and then we'd go to chemistry and physics. And that was like our time off. So we'd be having the crack and we'd be trying to get the demonstrator to do the experiment for us and whatever. And he hated it. So he'd be telling all his friends about stupid medical students. And when they found out that he was dating one, to this day, they haven't let him forget that he got trapped by a medical student. He grew up in Limerick City. So it turns out that I went to Laurel Hill School in Limerick City, even though I lived in the country, and he went to St. Clement's School, and the two schools shared a tuck shop. So I probably crossed paths with him every day for 6 years and never met him. Then he was in college doing his BSc while I was in medical school, never met him until my last year. So we kind of had overlapped for about 12 years in the same place and then met just as I was about to leave to start working in Dublin. So I guess you could say that it was meant to be. He did his PhD and out of his PhD, he went to work for Merck Sharp and Dohme in Ballydine. And at that stage, I had come back from England. I was working in the Rotunda and then I finished that rotation in Limerick. So on our first anniversary, we went to this gorgeous lodge somewhere near Clonmel, which is where we were living. And I said to him, you know, with a few bottles of wine. And I said to him, well, you know, we've managed to survive 1 year of marriage now. We have our house and we're all set and everything's going to be great. And, you know, we can relax. And because we've been living separately in separate countries all the time that we've been together, you know. And he said, well, actually, I want to move to Canada. Like, I nearly had to have an architect. And he was so cute. He waited until we'd had 2 or 3 bottles of wine because he knew I'd have bet the face off him if he told me like straight up. But anyway, long story short, it was very interesting. Actually, Merck wanted to open a lab in Canada and it had to be built from the ground up. And it was in process research, which is what Paul's specialty is, you know, where you take something that's been researched at a university or at the company and then you scale it up for clinical trials, you know, try to make it less expensive but bigger quantities, you know. He'd worked in the States with the group that were putting this together and they invited him to interview for it. So he went over to the States, did the interview. And of course, I was ashamed to say I prayed he wouldn't get it. But anyway, a terrible thing to do. I know I would never do it now. So he was up against all these Harvard and Duke boys over here for this big job in Montreal and did to get the job. And he was over the moon because they were giving him carte blanche to design the lab from the ground up with the builders and everything. We moved first to the US from Ireland when he got this job, but he had to spend time at Whitewater Station, which is the headquarters of Merck, before he went to Montreal. There were some things he had to do down here at the corporate offices beforehand. So at that point, we were living in New Brunswick because I am not the best driver in the world. So we had to find a house that was right on Easton Avenue so I could drive straight to work and straight back from St. Peter's Medical Center where I was working in research with the people from actually San Francisco, where I'd done my master's on a new method of measuring babies' oxygenation in labor called fetal pulse oximetry. So I had done the development work with that for my master's, you know, developing the probe and everything. And they just happened to be starting a US multi-center trial. So when they heard that I was moving to St. Peter's, they made St. Peter's one of the sites for that trial. So everything really fell into place for me that time. So I spent about 18 months at St. Peter's. So then he went to Montreal and I stayed in New Jersey for a year while he was up there. And I'd go up to see him and he'd be like, with the hard hat and the boots and going out to dinner with the builders every night. So it was a brilliant experience for him to get to design the lab the way he wanted and everything, you know. But then Merck got into some financial issues and they ended up closing all of their plants that weren't stateside. So even though the Montreal plant was the one where they'd had like one, two, three successful drugs after another, we never thought they'd close Montreal, but close it they did. And that's how we ended up down here in Princeton.
And did you like Montreal?
Oh, Paul, we absolutely loved Montreal. And this is in spite of November to April being literally encased in snow. Like at our house, there would be at least 3 feet of snow piled up from November, frozen solid until April. And I would have to drive to the Vic up a hill in my tiny little Suzuki Jeep with my heart in my mouth and the kids in the car seats in the back, you know, for the best part of 6 months. But man, that city, like once the 1st of June came, we would even try not to go on holidays in the summer because every single weekend there was a festival. And, you know, it started with the Grand Prix and ended up with the film festival at the end of September with, you know, the Franco Folly, the French music festival in between. I mean, what a city to live in. We had a wonderful experience. And ironically, it's the longest place I've ever lived in my life. I lived there for 14 years and we had both of our children there. So our children are French speaking Quebecers, as they like to remind us when we tell them they're Irish. So we tell them that their Irish blood will never leave them. They may have been born in a place, but they're of Irish descent, you know?
Well, now that Helen has chosen to bring them up, let's learn more about Luke and Lauren. And tell me a little bit about your two kids when they came along and all that.
Well, you know, they took their time, I'll put it that way. Paul was very much about, you know, let's build our careers and let's spend time together and really have ourselves rock solid before we have kids. But then, as often happens to couples, when you put things off maybe a little too long, you have difficulties and whatever, you know, getting pregnant. So for ages, we were trying, nothing was happening. So we just come to the conclusion that maybe we weren't going to be parents, you know? And then he was away on a trip and I found out that I was pregnant, but I found out that I was pregnant the day that I miscarried. So I had the sad news that I had miscarried, but at the same time as my doctor and my friend and my boss at the time, Alice Benjamin at McGill, said to me, you know, at least we've proven that you can get pregnant. So this is actually good news. So I waited till he came back from the trip and I told him, you know, he was like, well, you know, just go with the flow. He's a very chill guy. He's really take it easy. We'll see what happens. And by some miracle, we went away on holidays to Nova Scotia. And when I came back, I was pregnant and that was with my son. But I was old. I was 38 at the time. My son now he's a student at Northeastern University in Boston, but he's currently on co-op for business in Atlanta with Goldman Sachs. And he's really happy with the work. He's happy to be making money and I'm sure he'll be happy to graduate. But at the beginning of his course in Northeastern, they have this really cool thing called NUN. So they send the kids away to a different country for their first term. So he got to go to Dublin for his first term with two other guys. Those are still his two best friends to this day, you know. So they had 6 months in Dublin with the different rules around, you know, being 18 and not 21 and all that kind of stuff. So he had a very fruitful start, shall we say, to his college life with all the aunts and uncles over there spoiling him rotten. Now he's set to graduate next summer.
Hot on the run, keeps the hand on the gun. You can't trust anyone. You are so sure what you needed was more. Try to shoot out.
Sadly, in the interest of full disclosure, which is a new thing for me, but also necessary because of the kind of music that I write, even though I wanted more than anything to be a mother, I had very severe postpartum depression after Luke was born. For about 3 years, I was on medication. My bosses at McGill, you know, brought me into the office and said, listen, it's none of our business, but we're really worried about you getting pregnant again because it's a known fact that it has a 50% right. chance of recurring in the next pregnancy, you know. So Paul and I were going back and forth and we were afraid to have another child or whatever. And then Paul, in his chill way, once I was fully recovered, he's like, you know what? We'll just see where it takes us or whatever. So thanks be to God, we were blessed with a daughter, Lauren, who's just an absolute joy of a child. And she's a senior in high school here in Princeton right now. Just got her driver's license. So my car is gone half the time, but I couldn't be happier. She is going to be going to college next year and she wants to study psychology so that she can help people. My husband has a much better ear than I have when it comes to music. Like all of my recordings, mixes and everything, I run through him before I sign off on them because he can hear things that I can't hear. And the two kids seem to have inherited his ability, right? He doesn't have an interest in playing instruments except drums. So he says when he retires, he'll take up the drums. And he does sing in the car, but we can't get him to sing anywhere else, even though I think he has a gorgeous voice. Lauren is a fabulous singer, but she's very interesting. She loves to go to the studio because it's dark and she gets on better with my producer than I do. He keeps telling her, you're so much better than your mother, you know, and she loves that. But she doesn't like performing on stage. She featured on one of the songs on the last album, Stay Here Now, the song I wrote for my mother, and she did a fabulous job. Luke doesn't sing at all, but he has a really good ear.
Like his dad.
And he also tell you he has good music taste like his dad and not like his mother.
Let's take a deeper dive now into Helen's creative work.
I'm working on a project now in Boston. It's a crowdfunding project. It's a very unique project, Paul. It's a project about grief for the grieving. And it's all a cappella. So it has some songs that I've written that I've already recorded with full bands that we're going to do a cappella arrangements of. And the lead single that we just finished at the end of August is a song by a woman called Jude Johnstone in Nashville called The Hereafter. So she apparently has worked a lot with Van Morrison as well as Clarence Clemens, who was the sax player with Bruce Springsteen. So I started looking into her portfolio of songs. They're just amazing. She's like the queen of melody. Her melodies are just gorgeous. So when we were doing this grief project, my producer in Boston, Carter Sanders and myself, I went through 71 songs about grief, including four that I had written myself that I didn't really set out to write, but they're the songs that came out of me because that's what my life was at the time. And you tend to write who you are, you know? One of the songs I found was The Hereafter, the song by Jude Johnstone. So when we narrowed down all the songs, we got down to the final five, both Carter and I picked this as the lead single because it's so beautiful and so poignant. So I called Jude up and I said, Jude, look, we're going to record your song. I've already gotten clearances and licenses and everything. It's going to be a cappella. Is there any chance that you'd feature on it? And she said she'd love to. Jude and I singing with students from Berkeley in Boston, taking all the a cappella parts, all arranged by Carter, my producer, and it is absolutely stunning. So I'm so excited the way that it's come out. So I'm just going to continue and do the whole album like that with some guest artists, and one of them will be my daughter, Lauren.
Though our hearts are too heavy to find comfort yet, there are no words written to help us forget. We hold on to the memories and wait for the rest.
that will be my first crowdfunding project. We already crowdfunded enough for the first single I did with Jude, but then we'll go back in and we'll do a full album like that, and it will be directed to people who are grieving. It would be a gift that you can give to somebody who's lost their person, just so they can curl up in a room with the CD like I did when I lost my father. I curled up with three songs and just played them over and over and over again until the hurt got a little less, you know?
So what exactly caused Helen to finally leave medicine behind and go full on into music?
I was here in this gorgeous house in Princeton looking out the window. Once I got the kids to school, he was at work and they were all settling in and making friends. And I was saying, at this age of my life, do I really want to start making friends again? I was in a very low place, right? And my husband came home and he could see things going the wrong way quickly if he didn't intervene. And he said, you always wanted to sing. This is your chance. So the funny thing was, we hadn't even unpacked the boxes. And in the mailbox, I got one of those things you get from, you know, the schools, Mercer County College. Here's all the adult classes or whatever. And one of them was called Singing is Fun. So I signed up for it and I went to the first class that week. And I was singing with all these, you know, older people like myself and having fun with this woman called Alta Malberg, who turns out to be an amazing vocal coach who lives locally but has worked a lot in New York City. And so I stayed with Alta for a good while. Then in 2014, around Labor Day, I was looking in my email, and I'm a big fan of Groupon, and they had a recording session where they had money off. And I was like, oh, that sounds interesting. But when I looked into it, it was like for a rap person. So it certainly wasn't for me, but it got me thinking. And I said, okay, what are the two things I love? Recording and the beach. So I put in recording and the beach, thinking something would show up in California or something. And fair enough, in Long Branch, New Jersey, an hour from my house, I found Shorefire Recording, run by Joe DeMeo. And in that write-up was this fantastic producer, Mark Swirsky, who's also a music mentor who had won 2 Grammys, and messaged Mark if you'd like to talk to him. So there's nothing more dangerous, Paul, than a woman of my age, because I have nothing to lose, absolutely nothing to lose. So I send off this email to Mark. He was working at the time with young kids who wanted to be on The Voice or American Idol or one of those shows. So it was only when we were on the phone together talking that he realized, A, I had children, and B, I wasn't 18, right? So he said, well, this is interesting. He said, because you're not my usual demographic, you know, you're not coming on like I want to be a star and show me what I need to do to be a star. I'm like, no, I want to sing and write songs and I don't really know what I want to do with them. So anyway, long story short, I was working with his vocal coach who worked with his stars, Rich Bozek, in Highland Park in New Jersey. So New Jersey is full of talent when it comes to music. You know, it's not all down in Asbury Park. And into the studio for the first time in May of 2015. And Joe DeMeo treated me like a princess. It was amazing. And that was the day we recorded my cover of Simple Man by Lynyrd Skynyrd that's on the first album, And Mama Told You.
And listen closely to what I say. And if you do this, it'll help you some sunny day. Take your time, don't live too fast. Troubles come, they will pass. You find a woman, oh baby, you'll find love. But don't forget, son, there is someone up above.
Walk us through the transition from med to music, the pivotal moment, shall we say.
Very interesting that you would use the phrase pivotal moment, because the very first song I wrote with my producer, Mark Swirsky, is called Moments. And it contains the line pivotal moment about the moment that that transition happened. I walked into his writing room. In this room anyway, in Mark's writing room, it actually did feel like a totally spiritual experience to me, because I brought him the melody for what I thought was a chorus. And he said, that's not a chorus, that's a verse. But within 3 minutes, he had played the chorus to go with my verse on his guitar. So when I left his room that day, I had a verse and chorus melody for what became Moments.
So far off course, losing all hope. It's hard to live like this and be a spiritless shadow of who I once was, drowning in sympathy. And I hear you are like a true North Star. You're like guiding me in. There's a sign in your shelter.
One of the lines in the song is a pivotal moment in time, because during that hour that I was with him, two things happened. At one stage, you know how sometimes when you're at a funeral, I don't know if it's just in Ireland this happens, and the sun just shines in the window in that beautiful way where you can see all the dust and everything, and yeah, you know that it's the person like is bestowing that on you. That exact thing happened in his room, and I knew my father was there, and I knew that my father was sorry that he hadn't let me do music and that he was bringing me to the best of the best of the best in this Guy Merksworski with these two Grammys, one of which, by the way, is for the soundtrack of Bodyguard, which is one of the biggest selling records of all time. That was one thing that happened. And the second thing was that in that room, I made the decision without telling anybody. I told my husband right after. I made the decision in that room. I am here. I am where I'm supposed to be. And I am never going back to medicine. I'm going to use medicine, the healing side of it. I'm going to incorporate it somewhere in my music, and I'm still going to try to be a healing force or presence in the world. But this is the day and this is the moment that I am deciding that I'm going forward in music. So that was the pivotal moment. I've brought out four actual albums that you can hold in your hand. April 2016, I had my first EP release show for the full Mama Told You. And on that, I had, I think, five original songs and one cover, Simple Man. And then the following year, I released a full album that had those five and another five original songs. Then I released a Christmas album that has five songs, A Little Christmas Kindness. And then last year, I released the one that we did the release show at the Bitter End in New York in April of this year. It's called Know You're Enough. I've written and released, I think, 21 songs totally, because some of them aren't on albums, right? For instance, we did a new revisited version of Fairy Tale of New York. Now, I know that's the Holy Grail and I know nobody touches it. But the problem was, Paul, over here in the US, nobody would play it because of the piece with the profanity in it, right?
Yes.
I said to Mark, my producer, I said, this is such a shame. This song tells you Christmas is coming in Ireland. The minute you hear the opening lines, you know it's Christmas time. And it's one of the best songs, in my opinion, ever written. And people should be able to hear it and they shouldn't be denied it because of the profanity. So I went ahead and I changed the lyrics and I took out the pieces that would offend anybody and kept the feeling, right? And Mike Montre on this track, like we did it as a duet as well, but we rearranged it differently. We don't do it the same way that Kirsty, God rest her soul, and Shane McGowan do it. We do a totally different arrangement. And it's not in any album. That's why I started talking about it. But it's interesting because when I took the arrangement to Mark, my producer, he came back to me and said, we should cut that all together, that piece where the profanity was, rather than altering it, where people are going to probably lambaste you on social media. He said, we should just drop it. The song doesn't need it. And I argued with it back and forth. You can't. It's the turning point of the song, blah, blah. So finally, anyway, as he always does, he made me see reason. Went in the height of COVID, recorded it with Mike, and we put it everywhere up on Twitter. And I tagged Steve Lillywhite, who had produced the original. Kirsty McCall was his wife. She sadly got killed in an accident. He produced that track for the Pogues. And may even have had a hand in the writing of it. And he on Twitter came out and said, this is a brilliant version. Love the drop bridge, which meant he loved what Mark had done by dropping the piece that right. people didn't like, because it made the song even more poignant and more sad, and didn't focus on that. So that's been doing really well. Like, there's a radio station that's played that all year round.
'Twas Christmas Eve, babe, in the drunk tank, and no one said to me, won't see another one. And then she sang a song, the rare old Mountain Dew. I turned my face away and dreamed about you. Got on a lucky one, came in 18-1. I've got a feeling this year's for me and you. So happy Christmas, I love you, baby. I can't see a better time when all our dreams come true. They've got cars big as bars, they've got rivers of gold, but the wind goes right through, it's no place for the old. When you first took my hand on a cold Christmas Eve, you promised me Broadway was waiting for me.
And I have another song that's doing very well called Unbecoming by John Prine. Do you know much about John Prine? I didn't know much about John Prine when I lived in Ireland. When I came over here, one of the lads that I sing with sent me Angel from Montgomery, and I fell in love with the song. I couldn't understand how a man could write a song that literally looked inside a woman's brain. You know, there's a line in there, how the hell can a person go to work in the morning and come home in the evening and have nothing to say? And for any woman who has lived that in any chapter of her life, the fact that a man could write that song from a woman's head always fascinated me. So I became a huge John Prine fan, not just in terms of his singing, but I really studied his songwriting and how he wrote very plain language and the truth of what people see.
Take a little Prine time when you're feeling kind of low. The rhythm of his rhyming will make you tap your toe. Words that flow like fine wine will chase away your woe. Spread his love and kindness everywhere you go. The man, the myth, the legend, he answered every call. From paradise to Nashville and the hills of Donegal. From Paris in the springtime to Montgomery in the fall. Americana's Shanaki is missed by one and all.
I got to open for our very own Irish singer-songwriter Karen Casey at the Hopewell Theatre here in Hopewell. And I was accompanied by a local master guitarist called James Popick. And, you know, the theatre was full of my friends and Karen's fans. And it was one of the best experiences I've ever had. That was one of the highlights of my life. We're three songs in on the new album with Mark that I am financing myself. I try to do one a year, so I save up. One of them, I've written a song for my favorite artist, who's called Brandy Carlisle. I'm trying to get that to her so she can listen to it, and hopefully if she likes it, we'll bring it out. And then the other song I wrote goes back to the time that I told you about earlier, where I had the 3-year experience with severe postpartum depression.
Yeah.
And I learned a lot in there in terms of, you know, suicidal ideation and making plans and that kind of stuff, which was so ridiculous when you have a 3-month-old baby and a husband who works full time. And in the last year, two of my friends have lost their brothers. And I don't even use the word suicide anymore. I don't even use took their own life. I will call it what it actually is and should be called from here on out. They died from terminal depression.
Of this
So just like terminal cancer that you can't cure, there is such a thing as terminal depression that cannot be cured. And that is what these people have died from. And I did lose a very close friend to this terminal depression, Cornelia, about, I would say, 6 or 7 years ago. And so I dedicated this song to her, and it's called For Me and You. Because it hurts so deep inside when you saw me try. Now I see. All you wanted was to keep on loving me. It's written from the point of view of the person who had terminal depression and who is now free of it, but messages back to the mother, the sister, the brother, the husband, the child, saying, this is exactly how I felt. And it's pretty graphic about how they felt, because you can't understand it if you haven't felt it. And they thought that everybody would be better off if they weren't there. They know now it's not true, but they also want the people left behind to know that it doesn't affect them getting into heaven. It doesn't affect you getting into heaven. That, like, God loves us the same as if nothing happened, like, without using the word God, if you know what I mean. But it's designed to console the people that are left behind and offer them some truth as to what's really going on in a mind that is no different from a pancreas and diabetes that doesn't have the right reaction to the neurotransmitters, if you know what I mean. And it's that conversation was had, and it's time that we treated these poor people, often kids, who have terminal depression differently, and their families. That's my big project right now. And all of those sounds are going to go on an album that will be classified under contemporary Christian. And it's going to be called Sturdy Souls, after the Brandi Carlile song that I took the line from. I have a song called Beautiful You. And the story of that song is really interesting, because I was invited to be a member of the Recording Academy last year, 2021. And that for me was a huge endorsement to have come from medicine into music, because to be accepted by the music community at that level means that I'm doing something right. So I was really happy about that. But I immediately volunteered to be a Grammy U mentor, which is where you mentor younger artists that are coming up through the ranks, you know, and try and pass on any knowledge that you have or that you're continuing to get, because I'm a lifelong learner. So I just keep trying to learn more and more about the music business as much as I can. So the mentee from New York that they partnered me with was a young Latina girl called Yancy Abril, just such a go-getter. Really reminds me of my father and myself. I'm very, very fond of her. And what she wanted to learn from me was songwriting. So she had written songs herself, but she had never collaborated on songs. So the long story short is we had to find common ground, because, you know, if you're hiring a songwriter, it doesn't matter. You can just tell them what you want them to write about and they'll do that. But because we wanted to do the creative process together, the only thing we had in common, because I come from Ireland and I'm ancient and she comes from New York and she's young, the only thing we had in common was that I'm a mother and she's a daughter.
Afraid to head out alone, but still I rise. This is where we say goodbye to the mother and the child.
And I always wanted to write, remember I talked to you about father and son earlier? I always wanted to write the female version of that song, you know, the mother-daughter thing. So we've ended up with the beautiful track called Beautiful You. It was produced by Mark down in Asbury Park at Dug Deep Productions. And the owner there is Jack Daly. He's the bass player with the Spin Doctors. He's absolutely magnificent engineer. I absolutely love working with him. I've submitted to the Grammy ballot for this year. So it's like a full circle event that comes from me being invited to be a member, me trying to give back, this girl learning how to collaborate in songwriting, and mothers and daughters everywhere love it.
Heading into the great unknown, all by yourself.
Can you still still hear me, Helen?
I can, of course, yeah.
Okay. No, I just saw something on my computer here. Maybe it was telling me the internet or something was dodgy.
It even says on my screen, Paul Finnegan is talking.
Oh, great. Does it say in parentheses, would he ever shut up?
No, because anyway, I would ignore it because they're all saying that to me too. Yeah. And they're lucky to have me.
What did you say his first name was again?
Joe.
Right. And your mother's first name was?
Joe.
So I got husband, you. Josephine and Joe.
And my husband would always call them Joe Squared when they'd be coming to visit us in Montreal. And be like, when are Joe Squared coming? When do I have to go to the airport to get Joe Squared? And they used to get a great kick out of them.
Joe to the power of two. Thank you for listening. Our conversation with Helen took place in September 2022 over a less than optimal Zoom connection. It's a long story, but Helen and I persevered and got the job done. Don't forget to check out the companion website for this show, centerpieceny.com. That's centerpieceny.com. There you will find a link to Helen's crowdfunding for her grief project. And while you are on our website, you can learn more about this podcast and listen to past episodes. And please write a review or leave a comment. Feedback is always welcome. Maybe you'd like to share your thoughts on women's surnames post-marriage. Don't forget to look for Helen's music on Spotify. Search for Helen O'Shea. And let me take this opportunity to thank Aran Islander MacDara O'Connella for providing us with a sample of Shan No Singing. Again, find out more on our website. Once again, a special shout out to sound engineer Lachlan Hart, imaging manager at News Talk Radio in Dublin, for cleaning up the interview recording and giving the final draft for the episode a good lick of polish after it was all laid out. Leave a message with us on our website if you think you could use Lachlan's skilled services. Will we leave it like that so?